So I'd like to tell you about this poem I came off across about 15 years ago, and it really blew me away. Now, that kind of came as a surprise to me, because I wasn't really a poetry person, right? Like, I was at university, I was doing history, and I'd read some poems at school. I'd been forced to read lots and, like, write about them, but it never did anything for me, especially not compared to novels and stuff I actually enjoyed. But nevertheless, this poem, you know, really struck me. And the first reason it did is that I knew some of the lines, and I think you'll probably know some of them too. So, like, to err is human, to forgive divine. And it's not just one of these lines. Fools rush in where angels fear to tread. A little learning is a dangerous thing. And that's pretty amazing hit rate, right? Because these are not just things that I've heard quoted. These are things that I, like, just thought were part of the language. You know, you just see them, people would use them, like, unknowingly in a newspaper article or whatever. And I think if someone had told me, oh, no, someone wrote that, I would have guessed, like, oh, it's probably the Bible or Shakespeare. You know, he came up with half the words we use, so it's probably that. But no, it's actually all from this poem, An Essay on Criticism by Alexander Pope, who I'd never heard of before. It wasn't my bit of history. But Alexander Pope wrote this when he was 23 years old, right at the start of the 18th century, 1711. And it's this long poem. It really is a bit of an essay. It's 5,000 words in heroic rhyming couplets. And I'm going to torture you with my rendition of some of it in a bit, so you know what that sounds like. But the reason I'm talking about that today, this poem, is that as I went off and tried to earn a living as, like, a software engineer, I kept coming back to this poem because it had all sorts of interesting things that kind of, like, reminded me of it. And I went back and I was like, oh, this has got some good stuff here, some good ideas. And it's because, you know, this is an essay about criticism, but it really means judgment. Good judgment. Now, this isn't criticism in terms of just, you know, insulting people's work or, like, finding fault. This is, you know, what makes something good? What makes something a good fit? What makes something a good piece of work in any field? And when I told people about the idea for this talk, quite a few people thought it was weird because to them, engineering was all about unambiguous answers to questions that were, like, objective. But as an example, for people who, you know, weren't doing what I was doing, software, you know, like, what's a good coffee maker? Is it a big fancy one that can automatically steam espresso? Is it one that's very expensive or very fast? Or is it two pieces of plastic, an AeroPress? You know, there's no objectively correct way to design a coffee maker. And it's only really little sub-problems, like, you know, what pressure can the plastic take in an AeroPress, that really have an unambiguous answer. It's only when you get down to the weeds. Like, the big interesting questions that, you know, I certainly, and all the engineers I've known, and all the makers I really know, all the big interesting questions are about trade-offs. You know, they're much, much closer to any, you know, to the criticism that I was reading about in this book, in this poem. And we really can't avoid giving and receiving criticism as engineers, right? Like, we're going to be working in a team. Even if we're not, we're going to be releasing stuff out into the world. And even if we never do that, we're still going to have self-criticism. We're going to be looking at our work and considering what it means to do good work. So before I go on, I'm going to talk a little bit about Pope, because he's a very interesting chap. So here's a sculpture of him. But more importantly, here's a timeline. Just put him in a bit of perspective. So roughly 10 years before he was born, someone invented the pocket watch. This essay on criticism was written, you know, like, almost 10 years before Robinson Crusoe. And he died, and then some years later, the steam engine came along. And then the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. So that's kind of put him in his world a bit. Now, here's a slightly rude picture of Alexander Pope. And so you'll note that he is wearing a papal hat. And that isn't just a very lowbrow, dumb joke about the fact that his second name is Pope. It's because he was a Catholic at the time when it was really tough to be a Catholic in the UK, because you were a persecuted minority. There's something called the Test Acts had been passed, and it meant that you couldn't, if you weren't an Anglican, if you weren't part of the established church, you couldn't go to university, you couldn't teach, you couldn't hold public office. It was really rough. And so he had to teach himself. He was mostly self-educated. So it's pretty impressive that no matter that, when he was 23, he was writing this poem, which was, you know, a big success on release, as it were. So, I'm going to introduce Pope a little more through the eyes of his nemesis, a man called John Dennis. So he was a little bit rude in passing about John Dennis in this poem, An Essay on Criticism. And John Dennis wrote a kind of rebuttal of the piece in which he called Pope a downright monkey and went on to say that, you know, there's nothing so stupid as a hunchback toad. Now, and then he went on to say, just to kind of double down the unpleasantness, that had Alexander Pope been born in ancient Greece or ancient Rome, his parents probably would have put him to death within a day of being born. You know, unfortunately, that's what people did back in ancient Greece and Rome. They exposed babies who, you know, didn't think were going to make it. And he said that that was about as long as his poems were going to last, like half a day. And he's not wrong that, you know, Alexander Pope was quite short, and he was hunchback. He actually had tuberculosis that spread to his spine, and it meant that he never grew above 4'6" in his whole life, and he had really quite terrible health problems throughout his life. However, if there was a kind of revenge film, you know, fantasy from Alexander Pope versus John Dennis, but, you know, like a very literary kind of catty one where they continuously, you know, mocked each other in print, Pope definitely won. Because his poems, not only has his poems survived and are still studied, but, you know, we all probably know these lines, unthinkingly quote him, like he's, you know, he's definitely won. He's got the statue in the National Gallery. He's got the blue plaque. And if anyone knows John Dennis, it's as a footnote to this epically long takedown of all of Alexander Pope's enemies called the Dunciad, which is like a satirical play on the Iliad where he just talks about all the people he doesn't like. So that's Alexander Pope. And there's three big themes I want to talk about that I've learned something about, kind of, you know, principles you can apply to engineering or really making anything from this poem, The Essay on Criticism. So first off, it's really interesting to put all these famous quotes in context because they get much more interesting. So, good sense and good nature must ever join to err as human, to forgive divine. Pope saying here that, you know, we're all going to make mistakes. It's really when we start to forgive, as in to, you know, not just pick holes in people's stuff, that we're better than just like human. Okay, easily said, right? Like, that's a nice principle, but how? 'Tis not enough your counsel still be true. Blunt truths, more mischief than nice falsehoods do. So here's an interesting take. Pope's actually saying that to give people correct criticism in an unpleasant way is worse than actually talking crap and, like, literally talking untruths. Like, it is not enough to be objectively correct. You have to deliver it nicely. Again, probably something you agree with, but, like, how? Men must be taught as if you taught them not, and things unknown proposed as things forgot. I think it's really easy when we know stuff to set ourselves up as a, you know, as a teacher, as a, someone who, you know, knows more than you, and that creates that kind of unpleasant hierarchical relationship. As a kind of example, engineers in general, and maybe software engineers in particular, are kind of often guilty of this idea that we just need to give people objective, correct criticism from a point of view of expertise, and everything will be better and improved. And there's a nice example from Spock, who, you know, if you don't watch Star Trek, is famously emotionless and purely logical and very, very intelligent. So he's got this mission to go down to a planet and investigate, and he comes across a race of aliens who are not very advanced. And so he thinks the logical thing to do is to terrify them by demonstrating our superiority. You know, we'll show them all our lasers and all this stuff, and they'll just run away. Doesn't work out. One of his friends gets stabbed by this absolutely enormous spear, and everyone's very upset with Spock. And Spock gives the kind of the objective engineer defense, which is, I had a logical plan. I gave them some objective proof that we were superior to them. And McCoy, the doctor, says, well, didn't you think they would react emotionally to your point of view? And Spock's like, I'm not responsible for their outrageous, you know, irrationality. How dare they? You know, and this, I think you kind of see this, especially online, right? Like, I merely demonstrated my superior intelligence and knowledge to you, and you got upset rather than updating and, like, agreeing that I was right. To kind of go on a little more, Alexander Pope talks about this concept. When you see a piece of work that you're looking at, so something that you're, you know, you're maybe commenting on your colleague's work or whatever, if the means be just, the conduct true, applause in spite of trivial faults is due. I think there's two things to draw from this. The first one is, are you glad they did it? Are you glad this has arrived? And if you think about, like, let's say there's three trivial faults in your colleague's work, like nothing that's going to blow up the space shuttle, right? Just three things that you think could be improved. Do you lead with applause or just give them the three bits of feedback? Like, I think you'd agree it's probably better to lead with the applause, give them the applause, and then the three bits of feedback is going to go down a lot better. And then secondly, something I've been trying to do lately, as a software engineer, you review each other's work in quite small chunks, so you're doing a lot of review. You're iterating this relationship, right? Sometimes, even if you see some objectively, you know, in your opinion, trivial faults, again, not going to blow up the space station, it might be worth just giving someone an unmitigated great job, at least once in a while, rather than like pointing out these things. Because A, you may be wrong anyway, and B, that just feels a lot better to people. I love this quote from, this appears like very early in the poem, and it needs a little bit of explanation. "'Tis with our judgments as our watches none go just alike, yet each believes his own." Now, at the time I said that pocket watches were very new technology, and they actually lost millets of accuracy every day. So it was true that everyone's watch did have a different time. But what Alexander Pope here is pointing out is that nevertheless, there's something special about your watch. It's yours. It always kind of appears to Alexander Pope that it was his watch that was correct and everyone else's was wrong. And I think the metaphor, you know, demonstrates much more strongly with our judgments, right? There's something weird about thoughts appearing in our head that make them so much more special than if someone else had them, right? It's very hard to get away from. Now, I nicked that Star Trek example from this book, and I also nicked this thought experiment from this book. I really recommended The Scout Mindset. Not the best title, but an amazing book. And the title is, "How often should you be wrong at work?" How often do you remember being wrong at work when you have a disagreement with your colleagues? To kind of take it like a Bayesian point of view, right? Like, what's the prior probability of you being wrong? Imagine you're working with colleagues who are roughly the same, you know, same level of experience of you, maybe the same kind of level of education, hopefully about as smart as you. If you have a one-on-one judgment, let's say there's a 10% chance both of you are wrong, but the rest of that probability should probably be split between the two. Now, I realized it didn't feel like that to me. I was like, shit, I think I feel like I'm right almost all the time. When I'm having a disagreement, that's kind of how I go into it. I'm like, but, you know, all these reasons, also the thoughts in my head, so it's special. It's kind of scary. And I think it's kind of a thing to think about and reflect. It's like, am I wrong enough at work when I have these, like, disagreements of judgment? And if you can't think of many cases where you have been wrong at work, I mean, either you're in the rare and unfortunate situation that you are genuinely working with people who are, you know, just much worse than you, in which case you're going to get a new job. But if you are working with people you think are smart and like, you know, as good as you, and you've got things to learn from, if you can't think of those times you're wrong, it's worth respecting, like reflecting on it, right? The second big theme I've taken from this poem is pride. The idea of pride when we're trying to give good criticism to think and to give good judgment. And it's a big theme because Pope says, of all the causes which conspire to blind man's erring judgment and misguide the mind, what the weak head with the strongest bias rules is pride, the never-failing vice of fools. So for Pope, it's the number one enemy of judgment, of all the causes. And pride sounds like just like, yay, I won the competition, right? But it's a bigger concept. Like, we'd call it ego, status, self-respect, all that kind of stuff. That's what we're talking about here. And we're pretty status-driven animals. Like, that's how we work. And the mechanism by which pride works is pretty powerful. And Pope says here, pride, where wit fails, steps into our defense and fills up all the mighty void of sense. And it's kind of interesting that 300 years ago he came up with this concept because, you know, now we talk about, like, ego defense, right? Like, our mind is genuinely trying to defend us actively from feeling bad about stuff. So there's this weird thing, whereas if you don't know something or you kind of observe something that's proving you wrong, like, your brain is actually actively trying to stop you realizing that. It already comes into the defense, comes up with rationalizations. And I think it's an incredibly pernicious thing about our minds. And there's a quote from a kind of contemporary of Alexander Pope here, which I love. "Self-love is cleverer than the cleverest person in the world." I think that's just great. Like, I think we could all probably think of examples of people we think are much smarter than us who nonetheless do crazy things, seemingly out of pride, right? Like, it's extremely hard to stop. Education and intelligence don't protect us from this, and maybe they even make the situation worse. So pride is really, really tricky. It's really ubiquitous. And I think one of the particularly tricky ones for engineers, people who are doing something technical or anything difficult, right, where you learn a difficult thing, is this one. And this is going to put that famous quote in more context. A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not the Perean spring. For there shallow draughts intoxicate the brain, and drinking largely sobers us again. I love this one, right? Now this Perean spring, just it was talking about the muses, they inspired us in art and knowledge and all that kind of stuff. But what he's saying here is that the joy of learning difficult stuff is intoxicating. Like, it's wonderful to go off and do something hard, achieve that learning, understand it, and then you kind of want to demonstrate it, right? You want to use those tools. You want to maybe show off, right? A little. So Pope's saying something kind of shocking in a way, that learning can have downsides. Like, he's not saying, like, all learning is a good thing, which I think is kind of a common assumption. He's saying it's actively dangerous to learn a little bit of some things, some subjects. And I actually came across this recently on a blog I read, Gwern's blog, where he gives some really great examples of the kind of thing where they can be really dangerous if learned in a small amount. Formal logic, cognitive biases, so like the behavioral economic stuff, and statistics, he's saying, are particularly dangerous. I think that's true, right? They're very technical, they're very impressive to people who don't know them, and they're kind of very easy to overuse and put too much confidence in. So I've got a bit of a silly theory to share with you. Out of literature and poems like this, or a degree in behavioral economics, which is going to better prepare you to predict human behavior? Okay, so my argument is that it might be better to do the poems than the literature. Because first off, it's less intoxicating, right? This little knowledge is a dangerous thing. It's much less true of literature because they're not claiming to make precise, universal, measurable, objective measurements of the world. They're not attempting to give you a kind of machine like statistics or behavioral economics you can turn the crank, or a list of cognitive biases to turn up, like to tick off and be like, got it. Judgment's obviously required because it's a poem. You can't just say like, the p-value of the statistical test is X. Poems are not going to just like win the argument. Secondly, I haven't been aware of any kind of accusations of p-hacking from Jane Austen or like data fraud from Alexander Pope, unlike behavioral economics. And finally, books are really cheap. So even though I'm talking complete crap, and I probably am, much less downside. Now, you've noticed probably the problem with this theory. And this is Sturgeon's law, like 90% of everything, and I think that's possibly an underestimate, is crap. And I think that's actually, as I said, I've kind of become a little bit of a poetry person. I like some poems now, but I do think that poetry has a particularly low hit rate, even for poems I love, like W.H. Auden. I hate almost all of his poems, but some of them I absolutely adore. So what literature? What poems? There's an interesting thing about poems, about books and literature and ideas, is that they age backwards. Now, we unfortunately age forwards. If we're 60, we are going to last a lot less time than someone who's 30 most of the time. But books have the inverse quality. If a book has been passed down because it's useful for 100 years, it's probably going to last for another 100 years. This is an idea from Nassim Taleb. He calls it the Lindy effect. I won't get into why. So if you want to learn about human behavior, it might be worth going back to Jane Austen from 200 years ago, La Rochefoucauld from 400 years ago, or Seneca from 2,000 years ago, because these have been painstakingly copied and passed down and recommended as good guides to human behavior, as something that people are like, oh yeah, that's kind of how people work, for all this time. So there's a strong filter on quality. And like the more recent stuff, the popular science books about how people work, if they've only been around for 5 years, probably only got 5 years left. It's an interesting theory anyway. The final thing I'll say about pride is maybe there's a solution here. So Pope here says, it'd be great if you with pleasure own your errors past and make each day a critic on the last. See, the idea here is, if you try and develop an image of being well calibrated, so what I mean there is like being confident when you have reason to be confident, and also not to be confident or just be silent when you don't, and maybe even tell people that, then your ego is going to try and demonstrate consistency. Like your brain is like, well, that's my self-image, that's what people think. I've said that I'm like that. You're going to try and like generate some evidence for that, to be consistent with your self-image. one potential way to use this very, very powerful force of pride for good in terms of like trying to do good judgment. Now, the final theme is about doing good work. So Pope here says, "Regard not then if wit be old or new, but blame the false and value still the true." So what he's trying to do here is set up a very clear division between means and ends, and say we care about the ends, making work that's true, work that's good. And again, this is a dynamic that I think is particularly interesting to dig into. When we're doing something that's very difficult, that has a big division between people who know it and people who don't, people who can do it, people who can't, Pope's going to talk about something here that I think is a really powerful dynamic that can make us do bad work. "The vulgar thus through imitation err, as oft the learned by being singular. So much they scorn the child, the crowd, that if the throng by chance go right, they purposely go wrong." So vulgar, he's not talking about like, he's talking here about common, like normal people. Okay, so if you're an engineer, everyone else is the common people, right? The people who are not engineers. Also, he's talking about people who are like the norm in your profession, right? So if you're, again, an engineer, the normal engineer, as opposed to, I don't know, the learned engineer, but hopefully you're considering yourself. So the experts. And what does singular mean? Standing out, being unusual. Again, so we were talking earlier about, regard not if the wit be old or new, blame the false, like value still the true. Means and ends, right? And he's saying that so much do we want to stand out as experts, that we make pains to do things differently from everyone else, from both people who don't know the skill and also the kind of average. We're again trying to be singular, we're trying to stand out. I think this poem is an interesting example of that, right? Like the people, I think in general, like rhyming poems with a message. I think this is uncontroversial because you probably all know a musical genre, which is basically rhyming poems with a message, right? Hip hop. And incidentally, this poem is so much fun to do in the style of the Beastie Boys. So, that's your homework, guys. I'm definitely not rapping on stage. But you may have noticed that, like, if you were forced to do a bunch of like 20th century poems in GCSE, a lot of them are awful. They, at least to me, uneducated, you know, kind of peasant personality that I have, like, I really don't like poems that I can't make any sense of and don't sound nice to me. Okay, why is that? Again, I think it's because of that. So much the vulgar through imitation are, so much the learned by being singular. But like, really wanted to stand out. And as a case study, I'm not making this up, actually. Poetry people, poetry critics, really wanted to stand out from poems that people liked. This is a poem that people like. It's If by Rudyard Kipling. It's a poem to his son, John, and it's about how to be like a good person in the world. Now, it was voted the best poem in the UK, or the favourite poem in the UK. Muhammad Ali, the boxer, used to carry this poem around in his wallet because it meant so much to him. But another poet, Pablo Neruda, he's a great poet, came across this poem on the wall of his friend's bedroom. Look what he says about this, because this is definitely scorn. Pedestrian, sanctimonious, precursor of the Reader's Digest. Now, the Reader's Digest is very mainstream literature. It's not trying to set itself up with airs, right? Whose intellectual level seems no higher than someone's boots. He's pretty nasty about this poem, and I think this scorning the crowd thing really comes through strong, right? And maybe that's why poems, you know, the idea of like scorning the crowd has pushed poetry away from what people actually like, and maybe that's why we don't read so much anymore, but we do listen to, you know, hip-hop. And this is an interesting problem, because I think it's affected lots of things. It's affected me, I think, which is that I learned to be a software engineer to build cool stuff. Like, I went off and built, you know, websites for my friend, a blog for my friend's band, all this kind of stuff. And I honestly didn't really care how I did it. But then over time, I became a programmer, right? And I went and, like, hung out with programmers. I went to programming conferences and I read programming books. And I wanted to demonstrate that I was a good programmer. And so I started to care about things that no non-programmer cared about, certainly not me before I was a programmer. Like, oh, I'm going to build this website with Erlang because that's cool and difficult. But no one cares, you know? And it's because I was trying to demonstrate skill to peers. Again, this like trying to be singular, trying to be one of the learned, demonstrate it to myself that I was now learned. And this is an interesting thing that happens where the means become the ends. Again, you know, I was talking earlier about regard not if the wit be old or new, blame still the false, value still the true, right? We've got to keep an eye on the ends. An anecdote here, I've got a mate who is a very talented musician. He went off and did a music MA. So he's good at music. He goes to a bunch of people who are good at music and he learns music for a whole year. And he pushes all of that stuff into this composition. And at the end of it, his mum's like, oh, can I listen to your composition? And he's like, no, because you're going to hate it. And isn't that amazing? It's kind of an interesting dynamic that you can go and study by the people who are, in theory, like experts on this thing and get worse objectively. I like making something that people actually want. And I'm going to kind of step way outside of my area of expertise and say, I really don't like this type of architecture. It's really ugly. And I think this, again, this is a demonstration of this problem of trying to push yourself outside of what the common people like might want to design or like to demonstrate that you're one of the learned, one of the kind of experts. And I think it's interesting that when people are asked to design dystopian future structures that look oppressive and ugly and unpleasant, isn't it weird that this top left is Judge Dredd, you know, depressing megacity one. The bottom right is Le Corbusier, kind of, you know, theoretical forefather of stuff like brutalism. They kind of look spookily identical, right? That's pretty weird. And there's an amazing debate about architecture back in the 80s between Christopher Alexander, architectural theorist, and a famous architect who, honestly, he's gone on to do some better work, but Alexander says, it looks to me like your friend Mineo intentionally wants to produce disharmony, ugly buildings. And Eisenman says, yes, you're correct. And Alexander like loses the plot at this point because he's like, isn't the world bad enough without you deliberately making ugly buildings due to architectural theories to kind of stand out? Which I certainly agree with. And there's a little example of this in software, which I, you know, hopefully do know something about it. I don't know anything about architecture. Don't listen to me about architecture. But you may have noticed that loading screens became a thing circa about 2009 on the internet and have never really gone away. And I think what happened was everyone saw Gmail, and they're like, wow, that's super cool. We can do like desktop-y kind of applications on the web now. I'm going to do that. But the thing was they were just building a blog. Or, as an example, every time I log into my my energy provider to find out how much money I owe them, takes me about 10, 15 seconds to load up the page. Megabytes of JavaScript, GraphQL, all this kind of amazing stuff to show me one number that I care about. And again, that's that thing, right? Everyone wants to be the person building Photoshop in the browser, working at Google, building Gmail. But unfortunately, not everyone is, right? You're just building a blog, so just do that. You know, regard not if the wit be old or new. Doesn't matter if you're using new or old techniques. Just do something that's actually good for the end user. In all this poem's given me absolutely loads. Hopefully some of those maxims like, you know, struck you as well as something that's useful for whatever kind of making you do. And hopefully some of you were like me, like you just thought poetry wasn't for you at all, but some of these lines maybe, you know, spoke to you in some way. I think they're really interesting and kind of easy to remember. They summarize the three big themes that I was talking about. And Alexander Pope ends this poem in a way that I think is a really, really nice kind of depiction of the kind of person that like I would love to aspire to be, and certainly the kind of person I'd love to work with in any kind of engineering project. Careless of censure, not too fond of fame, still pleased to praise, not afraid to blame, averse alike to flatter or offend, not free from faults, not yet too vain to mend. And if you enjoyed this talk, I'll pop it up on my website. I actually haven't done this yet. It's kind of that was silly. Or send me an email. And if you are now poetry curious and you want some other poems that sound nice and have a message, here's some recommended poems that I think you'll enjoy. I'm done. Thanks a lot.